We've got a little thing from what says it's the early Scottish, whatever that means.
Early Scottish.
The early Scottish. Connecting us from yesterday to today. I rise today through the strength of heaven, light of sun, radiance of moon, splendor of fire, speed of lightning, swiftness of wind, depth of sea, stability of rock, firmness of the earth.
Those early Scots.
Yeah.
What's going on, didn't they?
Right, exactly.
Some of the late Scots.
So I want to work today on the Gospel of John, and it's got a lot to offer us in our theme, but I want to start slowly with a little bit of noticing how the Gospel of John can often get lost underneath Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In other words, the predominance of readings in lectionary and the like are from the Synoptic Gospels. As a matter of fact, each of those has a year dedicated to it. John doesn't. And then when you hear so much in church about Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's interesting how we sort of are under funded on how to think about John. First of all, that's a really big question because it turns out John is quite different than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So, for instance, if you take, let's say, Mark, where Jesus, in his teachings, hardly ever talks about himself in Mark. Very rarely even refers, and especially is kind of not interested in people knowing who he is. And if somebody identifies Jesus in Mark, Jesus says, "Don't tell anybody." And he talks about a lot of different things in Mark, but not about himself. You look to John, and then the other thing in Mark is Jesus only talks in like two or three sentences at a time, these little parables or aphorisms, but they're not extended. Now, walk into John, and you have Jesus talking all the time about himself, and promoting. If he heals someone, in John, Jesus says, "I did this so you know who I am." And then Jesus overflows in the Gospel of John with telling people who he is. Indeed, one might say Jesus talks almost only about himself in the Gospel of John, and is the most, shall we say, divine of the Gospel of Jesus's. Jesus is identifies himself as divine, identifies himself as light relative to yesterday, identifies himself as the one who's been expected, as the Son of God. And so this is quite a different feel from Matthew, Mark, and Luke, in terms of Jesus. So I'm wanting us to learn and remember who Jesus is according to John today. And I'm mostly interested in it because also, since Jesus is more or less everything in John, including divine, I'm interested in us staying with the first part of John, in which that's said really loudly, indeed, of course, in contrast to Matthew and Luke, where Jesus is born as a human child. In John, Jesus is born at the beginning of the universe. So let's just take a look at that in John 1. So no kid in a manger here. You've got really very cosmic thing going on. And I'm happy if we don't have same translations, but would somebody read, let's say, like the first five verses?
So you can actually see.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it.
Hmm. Yeah, so let's sort of stay with that for a little bit. I mean, on the one side, I guess one would say, we actually don't have Jesus yet, right? Jesus was not mentioned in these first five verses. In fact, Jesus doesn't get mentioned until about verse 18. But we figured out, and we'll notice at the end of the day, that although the character here is identified as the Word, that ends up being one of the many words in the Gospel of John for Jesus.
Oh, really? Like the word in Hebrew, is it Davar? Is that the word?
Hebrew, it probably is Davar. More important, it's since this is Greek, it's Logos.
Oh.
So, and in fact, there's some lovely translations that do Logos a lot of justice. So Logos, that's just not like the Word. That's like the really big capital Word. Now, you can't write Word in too many capitals for John. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of things to say about that. First of all, that Logos, the Word, is really the key element of all Greek philosophy. So, Logos is the principle by which everything exists. In really almost all frames of classic Greek philosophy, Logos is the principle of being. In other words, it's not just, it's somewhat different in Genesis, as we saw yesterday. In Genesis, God speaks and creation happens. So there is a word being spoken in Genesis, but this is a much more elaborate word, depending both on Genesis 1 and on all of Greek philosophy. So, in the beginning was the Word, it's just like, on one level, if you're a philosopher, you know, you say, of course. But it's kind of shimmering in the place of Genesis 1. It has the same in the beginning in both John and Genesis. And it therefore carries with it the word that's being spoken in which God creates. But then it's almost like you want to say Logos is creativity itself, or being itself, or coming into beingness. A number of nice translations of Logos will translate this in John 1 as in the beginning was the verb. In other words, in the beginning was the active word. And then, of course, right with what we began, the Word is divine, is with the divine. Interesting play there. So it's not like the capital God, it's divine. So if this is the writer is with God and the Word was God, that's equivocation. That, in other words, that is not saying this is a divine figure and the big divine figure. It's kind of a medium-sized divine figure. In other words, there is another God that the Word is with, and in some ways, when you look at the Word, all you see is God. So, pretty big God. And then, of course, just what we said, all things came into being through the Word, or through the Logos. Again, notice the contrast between this and the baby in the manger. So this is the coming into beingness event that eventually gets identified with Jesus. We'll look at that in a little bit. And then again, as we saw yesterday, what has come into being in the Word was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome the Word. So I don't think we need to just stay here to remember that this is the way the Gospel of John is framed, as the creating presence, and as that which brought everything into being. We're going to see this afternoon that actually the Hebrew Scriptures have another figure which does that, and it's not the Word in Proverbs. But for now, we'll stay with this. And let's look at just a little bit further in verse 10. Let's read verse 10 to 14, through 14. Can someone read? And if you have in your Bible something that's not being read, wave your hand if it's too different, because the nice thing about having different Bibles is that points us back to the Greek. Yeah, because it's impossible to translate Greek completely correctly. So,
before we go on,
yes, please.
This translation says the darkness has not understood it.
Let's see.
I thought that was kind of different than.
Yeah, and you know, I left here just before the 11 o'clock hour because I knew that I forgot to go get my Greek New Testament next door in the library, and I think that you all have lost your Greek New Testament. I couldn't find it. So anyway, I can tell you I know this Greek. That is an unusual translation of the Greek.
Is that the Message translation?
No.
What is it?
Serendipity?
Well, no. I was the one that brought it in here, so it's my fault.
So I picked this one up by myself. That's NIV. Yeah.
Oh, it's NIV. Yeah. Interesting. I'm coming up blank for you, Nancy.
Okay.
That is an unusual translation of the Greek. Would someone read 10 to 14, please? John 1, 10 to 14.
And he was in the world, and then the world came into being through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own, and his own people did not accept him. But to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood, or of the will of the flesh, or of the will of man, but of God.
Sorry. Yeah, okay. So the he is still the word. In other words, we haven't got Jesus mentioned yet. This is going to be Jesus, and the medium-sized divine Jesus, as we said. But here he's beginning to have a story. Notice? So at first it was all the way the word is associated with creativity and the beginning of everything. Now the word is coming into the world, and the world is and came into being through him, more of that, yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own, and his own people did not accept him. Okay, so now we're getting a plot here. So even though this is the one who has made everything, his own people are not accepting him, but in the Greek here, you could translate that but or and. And to all who received him, who trusted in his name, he gave power to become the children of God, who are born not of blood or of will of the flesh or of the will of people, but of God. So,
you have something different.
Well, it's really an interesting translation. This is really interesting. It says, children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or the husband's will.
Again, I have not ever seen this translation. I would want to credit it with, it sounds, and I'm glad that you answered, is this the message? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes the message is really interested so much in getting a contemporary understanding that it goes into paraphrasing. And I think that here, this is trying to do more of that. And that's often very helpful and often not very helpful. I would say one of those three is worth following up on, and the others are a little overstated. So again, here now we have sort of the plot of Jesus, or the Word, in John, and that is, he created everything, people didn't accept him, but those who did accept, and there the word is actually also more like trust, who would trust him, they were given divine power too. They were made into children of God. What we'll see later, maybe I'll do this now, too. So this is one of the main things we miss about Jesus' John. Because Jesus' John is so divine, the dogmatics and the doctrinal crowd really gravitated toward Jesus in John. And therefore, in other words, this is doctrinal material will cite the Gospel of John as the real divine Jesus. And weirdly, in Christian doctrine, that then is dissociated with being human. In other words, Christian doctrine, when it sort of lands in the Gospel of John, where he's divine, that means that he's far away from humanity. That's not the case in the Gospel of John at all. In other words, just because he's big time divine doesn't mean that he's far from humans. In fact, it's the opposite. You notice right here that if you trust him, you yourself become a child of God. And that childness throughout the Gospel of John goes something like this. You'll remember this. So Jesus will say, he says it like every page, I'm in God, and God's in me, and I'm in you. So in different ways, Jesus is always saying, I'm in the Father, I'm in God, I'm in the divine, and the Father's in me, and God is in me, the divine pulses through me, all of those kind of phrases. And then it says, but it adds in the same sentence very regularly, and you are in me, meaning humans are in me. In other words, one participates in God through Jesus. So this is quite different than the way humans are described both in Christian doctrine and in Christian and in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where people are people. But here people become divinized in the Gospel of John. And again, that's why I don't think we understand that near as well as we could, because of the way the doctrine developed around that. In other words, if Jesus is great, then that Jesus is a sign of how much sin there is in humans. It's the way the doctrinal thing works.
Maybe I'm off base here, but the other sort of feeling is this section sort of feels to be the foundation of the doctrine of the Trinity, or is it the origin of that, the theology of the Trinity?
It's a great question. I would say probably a minority of my colleagues in biblical studies would say yes. Okay. And the majority would say, I would say implicitly one could see that coming. The only place in the entire Bible that you have Father, Son, and Holy Ghost is in the last verse of Matthew. And that doesn't mean the Trinity. It means something else. Here, you never have Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in the same sentence at all. And but you do have all three of those in John. Mm-hmm. So Jesus calls himself the Son a lot and talks a lot about his tightness with the Father. But Jesus brings the Spirit. Occasionally that Spirit is named Holy Spirit. So you see how this is almost, some people can say it's almost Trinity. Trinity will not get its act together until the 3rd and 4th century. But there's a kind of a closeness in that.
It's sort of the read I had in my head. Mm-hmm. Well, the Word being the Spirit, God. Mm-hmm. And
so those three ways of thinking about are there. John doesn't make much of it being some kind of unity. There's some implicitness there. So let's stop here and take a deep breath about this kind of Jesus. So the Creator Jesus, the one who made everything, and the Jesus who is both divine and divinizing. Questions, thoughts, protests? So for me, before we go on, I would just want to say the relationship to So it's the world itself that comes into being also in Jesus. So Jesus makes the world, and so Jesus is at one with the world as well. Now there's a couple of vocabularies about world in John, and we can go back to that if we have time. But so this, for those of us interested in ecology and the brightness and the power of nature, this is probably the closest in the New Testament that we get to that kind of picture of Jesus and God. The New Testament is not as, doesn't have as much about what we might call the natural, the way the natural participates in the divine, as the Hebrew scriptures do. But this is probably the way that it comes closest. We'll read some more stuff throughout this weekend that are a mix of both of those. But tell me the kind of some of the questions, interests you would have then in this kind of Jesus and this kind of in Jesus in this vein.
How much later was this written than the Apocalypse?
Actually, right now, I would say it's actually the third out of the fourth. We used to think it was the last one, but in the last 20 or 30 years, Luke is slipping into the second century. So it looks like the order of, well, I mean, if we include St. Thomas, Thomas and Mark are the first ones, then Matthew, then John, then Luke. So it's not so much that it's late, it's just different. So in other words, at first we thought, yeah, that's just Jesus on the way to becoming really God. But that seems to be pretty early. And, you know, Paul, who's the earliest writer of them all, he's not hesitant to say Jesus is God. And again, it's a kind of a medium-sized God in Paul, not the fully omnipotent God in some way. Well, Nancy, were you...
No, I'd always heard that this was later.
Yeah. I would say probably about half of my colleagues would still be there, but they probably are not reading a bunch of the things in the last 20 years. Don't get me started on Luke. Luke is really interesting, but Luke is really falling beautifully into the second century. Last winter, I was talking about how the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Mary fit really well in about 120. So I want to say that both in Paul and John, but more poetically in John, this unity between humanity, the world, and God is quite articulate. So, the other thing to say then about Jesus' story quickly is how important the death of Jesus is in John, and differently important. First of all, Jesus in John, keeps calling the threat that people are going to kill him his glory. So he talks about his glory in specific relationship to his death. As far as we can tell, as in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, none of this is the kind of Jesus' death dies for your sins. That's a later concept than the New Testament generally, or even the first and most of the second century. So it's not that Jesus' death is important or glorious, because it sacrifices for sins. It's rather because it expands who Jesus is and who people can be in Jesus.
Say that again.
Yeah. It's who we are becomes more in as Jesus dies and still lives. No, it's not interested in getting us dead so much as us living
in God.
Like
what happens in the process at the same time.
So in other words, I guess I would want to say, is that Jesus' closeness to people gets more and more strong as John goes on. And Jesus' dying is one of the key places in which people and Jesus are unified. Jesus says also, you'll be glorified in me in my death. One might say this sounds kind of masochistic or sadistic in that regard. I don't think it's that kind. I think it's just beginning to say how important it is to integrate one's losses and violence into one's relationship to God. So Jesus becomes an example in his dying. And what's interesting there, and I frankly, some days I'm very interested in this, and some days I'm kind of scared about this, in the way Jesus dies in John. So a contrast is, so in the Gospel of Mark, for instance, which I like contrasting with John, I like both of them, but for really different reasons. In Mark, Jesus dies on the cross saying one thing. My God, why have you forsaken me? That's all Jesus says on the cross. It's torture, and it's successful torture. In Mark. In John, Jesus is on the cross and just is really in Jesus' glory. That is, Jesus dies, but Jesus isn't afraid. In fact, there's that, when you think of it, that kind of curious picture in John, this is the only place that you get this picture, so Jesus looks down from the cross, and there is his mother. And he says to the beloved son, take care of her. And he says to her, take care of him. In other words, he's just doing business up there on the cross. He is not fazed at all. You don't have my God, why have you forsaken me? Not a hint of that. And Jesus decides, only in John, Jesus decides when he's going to die. He said, okay, it's finished. So this is not to show how much better Jesus is than humans. It's to show how you die as humans. Or I would say, overarchingly in the Gospel of John, Jesus is, in trouble a lot. and the people around Jesus are sick and hurting and being oppressed. And Jesus all the time is just, I'm going to say, well, I would want to say cool, but it's not quite that, because Jesus cries more in John than in any other gospel. So Jesus is full of affect and feeling and power all at the same time. So what I want to explore is Jesus is a pattern of being, of us being in the middle of really violent, difficult, hurting situations and being in control. So here's where, and I'll just say a little bit about me. So I think this is really interesting, since we always underestimate, you know, the messes we're in and the difficulty that life brings us. I would even say the scariness of the world in both its natural and social forms. So all of that is there, and in John, Jesus just says, yeah, just let me at it. Let's go together right in there, and it's going to be fine. The thing that I occasionally worry about in this picture of Jesus myself is that he's never afraid.
Superhero.
Yeah. I frankly think there's more for me to learn on thinking about this in a helpful way. That is, okay, yeah, I get it. They're after me. Things are going wrong. I'm hurting, you're hurting, and let's go.
Well, yeah, there's almost like we don't have much choice in this anyway, so yeah. How about we just tackle it?
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, which... When I find myself in, like, I was going to use the word deep doo-doo, for lack of a better way. Uh-huh. And the only thing you can do is really go through it, right? I mean, you don't make very much progress if you're, like, if you don't participate.
Yeah.
And you're...
in the wallow.
Yeah. I mean, at some point you kind of have to decide, all right, I'm going to get off the couch and we're going to, I don't know, whatever it is. I guess I was thinking a little bit about the summer and about what that was like day after day. Things got more complicated and just more of everything. And like it wasn't going to help to pretend that that wasn't happening.
Right.
So the only thing that there was to do was to get up off the Sunday school room floor and participate in the day.
Yeah, right.
And, to talk to the people you need to talk to and to, try to be with the people that you needed to be with and do what you needed to do and then be done with the day and then do it again. Mm-hmm. And so...
And the beautiful thing about John in that regard is there's no lack of challenge and hard stuff. And all kinds of misunderstanding, people coming at him from every direction. Although he's not afraid to cry, he does not hesitate. Whereas, I mean, the thing I like about Mark's Jesus is Mark's Jesus sometimes thinks, oh no, I give up! Yeah. Well, you abandoned me, God. I'm cool with both of those kind of spiritual models. But this is really a special one.
Yeah, I get that sense because of the setup of John, this sort of
creative energy, right? This sort of, that it's in him, but it's also beyond him and works through him.
Yeah.
So there's this massive, it's not just word, but there's this force that comes through. And it seems that many times he relies upon beyond him, through him, in him, and whatever to endure or to resolve or to have something beyond like seen.
Yeah, definitely. And or another way of saying something near that. So if this is the way everything comes into being, why should he be worried? He's already seen everything come into being so far, and this is an ongoing creation. So it's not that he finished that before, it's always an ongoing creation, and he's confident that the God who creates is in him and in the world.
Yeah, maybe even you're describing that like the sense of the forest, so not just in humans, but in
totally.
All of creation.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's mourning the loss, but it's also, well, it's not the end, it's just another phase, it's another rejuvenation, it's another ongoing rhythm of life and death.
Yeah, so, I mean, those first five verses that we read of everything comes into being through this person, or this dynamic. That's the what you take right into the heart of the pain and the challenge.
I'm thinking about what Chuck said. You were talking about the forest, that's what you said.
Yeah, of course.
I feel like I'm always disagreeing with you. But I don't think that the forest mourns at all.
Oh, I don't think it
mourns.
Oh, okay. No, no, no.
So, you know,
people,
like,
I think people might mourn the forest. No, that's not what I meant.
And
like,
then...
it just goes on.
Okay. Going back to what Peg was saying, like the deer or the squirrels or whatever, they don't sit down and cry because there are no nuts left, okay? They just get up and to where the nuts might be, right? They just have to keep going. So,
yeah. Yeah. Oh, that... And oh, I would love to just stop in your...
Yeah.
In your I'd love to, for us to just stop a minute to hear from you all about the fire and all of that in these terms. So yes, in that way, the forest is just the same as everything else that is in process.
The forest is not afraid. The forest is not worried about what's going to happen next.
Right.
Whatever happens next is what's happening next.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And would you all say that? That's the way you felt about the forest?
Yeah.
Well,
no, I did.
Oh, it's quite a bit of projecting my own self. I mean, there was a, you know, I think when I would. Especially see trees actually burning, like I'm like I would personally feel bad, but I was sure the trees were sad. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I just like I'm pretty sure I knew that. Well, I'm not sure. I just know I did some projecting.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right.
For sure.
I would say, and I didn't see it. You know, I didn't see any of the burning. I wasn't there for that. But I would agree that the trees were in pain. But I don't know if they were sad.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, that's a good thing.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
Like, because we can suffer
yeah.
when we're going through things
yeah.
with and still accept them, maybe somehow.
That's a really good point.
Oh, you know, that reminds me of the primary model in John for that is not, unfortunately, in forests, but when Lazarus dies, Jesus is sad.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus is sad. He cries because his friend died. And then something else kicks in.
Or maybe even because the family of his friend's friend are sad. That's why I think he cries.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, beautiful.
I just remember sitting in some of the cooperator meetings with you, and you know they would say something, and you just would there'd be the gulp.
Yeah, well, yes, I would certainly respond. For sure.
So one more dimension of this piece of we being divinized by our closeness to Jesus. So we've been emphasizing, I think, the possibility that that can empower us and give us strength, as well as, I would say, elasticity as a person. But there's one other big thing going on in John about Jesus and us together being divinized. And that is this major contrast between who Jesus is and who the emperor of Rome is. Because in John, and this is something we don't get because, you know, we didn't live in the first century. But so the main titles that Jesus takes on are the titles of the emperor.
Oh.
So for instance, the Son of God, that's the primary claim of Augustus Caesar, is that he is the Son of God. And that is almost totally meant in the same language world as John, in that. So, and this is actually, most empires at that time claimed to be sons of God. And so that works a couple of ways. One is, I'm in charge of the world, says Augustus Caesar. He thinks the whole world is the Mediterranean anyway. I'm in charge of the world, and God the Father gave me in charge of it, and I'm doing this for God the Father. So I am the active son, says Augustus Caesar, of God in the world. And I'm running this, and I'm giving you peace and security, says Augustus Caesar. Now, this is so weird for us. So if you walked down the street in that ancient time and said, talked about the Son of God, most people would think you're talking about Augustus Caesar. We think Son of God is the natural title of Jesus. But John's use of Jesus as the Son of God is an imperial mocking. So in other words, everybody knows Jesus gets crucified, right? That's one of the primary things that you know about Jesus and reason not to trust him, because he failed. But, so John says, no, the real Son of God, who is really the tightest with, the closest to, the all-powerful God, is Jesus. So that's more or less a joke. Right? Because everybody knows there's way more evidence that the emperor is in charge. I mean, you put Jesus in the late first century alongside of the emperor, and everybody knows who's in charge, and it's not Jesus. But what Jesus what John does in the first century, in the first chapter of John, is say, no, this is the one you have to trust. You trust the one who is looking marginal, and you act as if he is the Son of God. So the Son of God thing in John is a contrast and a competition between the ruler of the world day-to-day, which would be the emperor, who decides life and death and everything else like that, and Jesus, who is a marginal figure for you when John is being written. Nobody's saying, yeah, we know Jesus is the Son of God. Everybody's saying, yeah, we know that the emperor is the Son of God. So this is, again, notice what happens to our divinization. So we say, yes, this is the person in control of us is this winsome divinizing process. Which is counterintuitive to Augustus Caesar with all his armies and all his wealth and all his commercial ability. So this is another thing that we don't get about John, is that it's not the Trinity. it's not the overarching power of God. It's a proposal to act like him in the middle of all kinds of trouble. And act as if a winsome God will be the best bet in the long run. I've been very taken in the last 20 years with, and some of you heard me on this, with this new empire critical study of the New Testament. That is, we forgot, when I went through seminary and my doctoral program, we didn't even talk about the Roman Empire and what it meant. But it's all over the New Testament. It's just, we didn't think about it that way. But for us to then think about our divinization process, our kind of unity with the forest and everything that lives, as being in a contest or in a competition against another way of being in command. So Jesus is a different way of taking charge than the emperor. Again, this is new to folks, so I'd be happy to say that doesn't make sense to me. Or to ask more questions.
Well, it seems like it might be a fitting thing to think about in this place and time.
Exactly. And especially in terms of the dramatic ecological challenges of our day.
And the way the world is polarizing, and the way people with power and money are a smaller and smaller percentage on the planet.
And to make this proposal that we can be ourselves creative and divinized. In a by following that courage and power of Jesus that says, yep, let's just do this together and watch how we all become more and more of God.
It might not end well.
Yeah.
And yeah. If what we're reading is any indication, it's not going to end well.
Right. And how to live with that possibility, I think, is really one of the main components of how spiritual practice can unfold for us. If we're not saying, hey, it might not end well, we're not noticing things, right? On the other hand, it seems like there is a active proposal. And again, I think the active proposal for all of these early Christ people is they get the irony of saying that. In other words, to say Jesus is Lord, like Paul does, or Jesus is the Son of God, like John does, that's both courageous and dark humor. In other words, to say that is and to keep pushing the contrast between Jesus and the ruling powers, as if no, we've got it. You've got to laugh sometime when that happens. Maybe cry too. But it feels to me like we have missed so much of the way the early church pronounced power and hope. And that was with a wink. In other words, we are naturalized Christians in the most powerful country in the world. So that's the way most Christianity thinks about how Jesus can give you power. Well, we already got it. But I think it's much darker, like you're saying. Well, so for the weekend, we started with Thomas and or we started with Genesis, then went to Thomas, and now to John. I want to say that, one of the sayings of Thomas and John are very close together as Gospels. And so, for instance, on my handout yesterday, there's this great saying of Jesus and John, and that is, I'm with you all the time. Chop open a piece of wood and I'm there. Turn over a rock and I'm there. So you can see very similar. This is a bigger claim than Matthew, Mark, and Luke make. So John and Thomas both say, hey, I'm here. I love the fact that Jesus and Thomas says, yeah, just pick up that rock. Here I am. Chop open that piece of wood. I'm right there. What I want us to do then is expanding this afternoon. We're going to look at the Gospel of Truth and Proverbs. And we're going to see a couple of other pictures of God and Jesus that keep going in the kind of the Thomas and John tradition.